So welcome to the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast, where we discuss all things money, because whether or not we like it, money matters. So I'm your host, Maya Fisher-French, and in case you missed it, this week is National Wills Week. So I thought it would be a really good idea to get some advice about what to do when it comes to writing up our will. So I've invited Alex Simonides, who is CEO of Capital Legacy, to join us. So welcome, Alex.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
And Alex, you know, as a wills and estate specialist, I think you must see a lot of the kind of mistakes and errors, perhaps, that people make
when it comes. We see a lot, yeah. We see a lot of the oopsies and daisies that happen given our size now.
And I know that number one biggest problem you have, and in fact, your team shared this with me, which was kind of like a shocking stat for me, I think, was that only about 30% of people proactively sign their will. So, Alex, I understand that meaning that 70% of people who've gone to the trouble of writing up their will, so it's not like they're ignoring it, they've written it, but then they don't sign it. I mean, is this actually something, a big trend that you see? I mean, that must be the number one mistake when it comes to writing up your will, is not signing it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a staggering stat. And it was actually worse not so long ago. We've actually improved on it. And we've been trying to get to the bottom of it for the last sort of 2 years. You know, like you said, you've taken the time to have an appointment. You've taken an hour and a half out of your life, either on a meeting like we're having virtually or at a mug and bean somewhere. You've done everything. You've drafted the will and then you don't sign it. So we thought, like, it must be something that's practical, right? And it was. And the fact is that people don't have a printer. The will has to be signed in its original form, as we've discussed before. And so if you don't have a printer, how are you going to print it? How are you going to get it signed? And so we've put some solutions out there that can help our clients. But then it's still stubbornly stuck at 30%. And I was actually chatting to some of my own staff, some of my own friends, and it's psychological, man. It's psychological. There's something about, for some people, where they have to put pen to paper on that will, that they kind of sense that, you know, they're bringing about their own mortality, where nothing's further from the truth. And so we're looking at new ways of actually overcoming that obstacle.
Yeah, it's so interesting that there is this sense, and I come across it quite frequently, there's this feeling like once I've done that, I've kind of been bringing this idea of death into my life. So Alex, I think a really good perhaps marketing thing could be for you to say, we have X amount of people who signed a will and have lived a long and healthy life afterwards.
Yeah.
There's no correlation.
If I can feel it, that's fantastic. Look, nothing will actually happen to you. If anything, you know, it's supposed to give you this release, this relief that you know, you've crossed your T's, you've dotted your I's, you've done this thing called a will, you've been a responsible adult, you've been responsible for the people that are financially dependent on you. It should be this relief. I get a relief when I sign my will because it's done. You know, you can put it away and you green tick all over your task list. So that should be but it's not what people are experiencing at the moment.
I wonder also, though, that isn't sometimes just that you know, people get a little bit too detailed on their will. So now they're trying to make, you know, cover everything. Think, you know, my sister will get this ring and my uncle will get that. And that almost, they're scared once they sign it that's now, you know, that's it. What if they change their mind? What if they want, you know, something different with their will? So do you think there's also the fact that we overthink the whole thing? Maybe that's also part of it.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Maya. Wills are totally overthought. For me, the best wills are the simplest and the most cleanest wills. If you've got a list of things that you want people to get, like wedding rings or a chair or a piece of, you know, maybe not an expensive art, but a little like something that's got a bit of memories to it, keep it on a little piece of paper in your drawer. It doesn't have to go in your will, and you can give it to your sister, your brother, your husband, your wife. Just let your will deal with the big stuff. You know, I want this to go to my spouse. I want this to go to my kids. Because remember, you're not there anymore. You're not there anymore. And I think it's exactly it. So if you're trying to make it too detailed, then it's going to hold you back from signing your will. The other thing that we also see, and I always discourage people from doing it in their will, but definitely put it on a piece of paper in your drawer next to your bedside table, and your bedside table is your pets. People agonize over their pets.
Of course.
And rightly so. I mean, I agonize over my pets. But your will's not the place to do it. A letter of wishes is the right place to do it.
Okay, so that's very interesting. So you can have a letter of wishes, which gives some kind of direction, And that doesn't have to be part of your will. And you can update that, of course, as your pets come and go and all the rest of it. There's an easier piece of paper. So I think that's some really, really good advice, actually, around just separating it. Just have the big stuff, the main stuff taken care of. And Alex, you know, I come across so many people who don't have wills. And I always get quite surprised that people don't have wills. But what I realize when I speak to them is they don't know what happens if you don't have a will. So let's start off with, you've written up a will, but you haven't signed it. What happens then?
So it's going to depend on your particular circumstance. So if I may use an example of a circumstance. So let's say, for example, you've got kids who are young, under the age of 18, and you want to provide for them. You want the house to go to them. You want the money to go to them. If you haven't done a will, you had no way of creating what we call a children's trust, a trust to put that house and put that money in, and to appoint people then to provide it for the benefit of your children. What happens is all of that goes to what we call the government's guardian fund. The house can't be sold. It needs to be signed for by the guardian, and the cash sits in the government guardian fund. Not a bad place, but it's not ideal. I mean, you don't want to be going there every month and trying to get your money for the next school fee, for example. Mm. So simply by doing a will, you could have taken care of that issue. I think the last one that I see as well, just to sort of be very general, Maya, you haven't appointed your executor. By not having appointed your executor, you've got this huge amount of uncertainty when you've passed away, and people run around like with chickens without heads. I found that families can grieve quicker if they know, this person's appointed these executors to take care of everything. They've got this point of call, if you may, this place of strength that they can go to. And when you've done out of will, you haven't appointed an executor, an attorney will be adjoined to the estate by the master of the court.
And of course, that delays everything, because I think the master of the court is already behind something like 9 months because of COVID. Now you come along and you still have to appoint an executor. You still have to go through that whole process. So you could be taking years to wind up that estate. And the impact that has on the family, it must be absolutely massive.
And factor in the infighting, because if there's no will, there's guaranteed to be infighting. I can guarantee it. In fact, if I don't, it'll be an exception. Mm.
And that's actually, and talking about infighting and wills and children's trusts, I had a very interesting question from a parent, and I want you to help answer this for me.
Okay.
So she's, and I come across this quite often with mothers. It tends to be a very mother-related thing. So she's married, and she has a retirement fund. She's got life covered. She has some assets, but not a lot. But she wants to secure these for her children's future. She said she loves her husband, but A, she's not convinced he's great with money, and B, what if he remarries? How does she protect her children? So I want you to talk a little bit about that. How does one, if you're worried about those sorts of things, or you're a single mom, which is also quite common, how do you protect your children and make sure the assets go to them?
So the first thing is, this is not uncommon. Whether married, whether single, this is not uncommon. And we see this more often than not. With the women who choose to be clients of ours, okay? And the advice is very simple. I would suggest that you do a will where you leave everything, you leave maybe 90% to your child, okay? In a trust that we just spoke about. And the reason why I say 90% is you want to always have 10% going to your spouse to prevent what we call a marital claim, depending on how she's married, okay? If you're not married, then obviously 100% to the kids. But the two other things that need to happen at the same time as doing your will with, say, 90% or 100% to this children's trust is that your friend, you said it was your friend, huh? She must actually go to her financial advisor and change her beneficiary nominations on her life cover. Because I bet you now what she's done is she's made her child the beneficiaries on the life cover. And the life cover will pay directly then into the child's bank account. And guess who's the guardian on the bank account? Her husband. Oh. We needed to pay the estate so that the estate with the will can go into the trust that you create in terms of will. And the other thing she must do is she must go to her pension fund at her work, and she must write on that, you know, you get these beneficiary forms at the company. She must write on there to my children's trust for the benefit of and whatever her children's names are. Then she is clear to the trustees that that is what her wish is, and they will consider it and probably give a disproportionate share than they normally would have in their award from the pension benefit. So it's not just about, you know, doing the will, it's about doing three things in this particular scenario. So it's a bit of admin, but then you're watertight.
That's such a good advice. So the life cover must go to the estate and not to the child's name, because the minute goes the child, then the father in this case would have would then be the guardian of those funds. The second thing is that she should. So that was an interesting one for me, because I know that the trustees, for example, of a pension fund can be guided, but they're not dictated by the will or by your nomination form. So in this case, they could also select, for example, to put the children's funds into a beneficiary fund, which is part of the pension fund umbrella, I suppose, that they could do that. But if she's got a testamentary trust or child's trust, then the trustees would probably consider that as well. So that's quite an important one. But of course, she also now has to decide who the trustees are going to be of this child's trust. So how does she go about doing that?
So the behavior of trustees of late, I'd say over the last 30 months, is they're more often than not now saying, no, we'd rather put in the children's trust and create a separate trust with separate expenses, as long as we put certain clauses in the will that can make it comply, which we obviously do. And I'm talking about big, big, big pension funds and big, big, big trustees have actually agreed to put money into these trusts. So because there's always that cost element that comes into it and that administration element that comes into it. But just going back to your example, just to make the viewers aware, if you've given everything in your will to your children, there is a very big chance, from my experience, that the trustees will probably make a substantial award still to the husband. So just to make that clear.
Yeah, well, I suppose there is. I mean, the husband still has a financial need, but I suppose she just wants to make sure that there's some assets that are kept for the children. And this remarriage thing is a very interesting one as well. You know, the husband remarries, what happens to your children? He maybe starts a new family. So this is, I come across this quite often. So quite a sensitive topic. Difficult also to sit down with your spouse and have that conversation, because obviously you want to tell them what the will, how the will's constructed. But I suppose one can have a constructive conversation around that and say, well, you know what, how do we both protect our children? And vice versa, his will can be exactly the same. You can structure the will so that the children's assets are protected. So just something, definitely something worth finding out about. And the other question, Alex, I get a lot of is, how does somebody find out if they are in a will after someone's passed away? So I get a lot of people saying, well, I never got to see the will. My family took the will away or whatever, or somebody in the family dealt with the will, but I think I may have been in it. How do you find out?
So principle number one when it comes to will: once it is registered at the master's office, it is a public document. It lays open for inspection. That's why you have to put these adverts in the newspapers to say, hey, this person's passed away. Please come to the master's office and inspect the will. So, but what your friend can do is, we can also, the master's offices have an online system, and we can actually query the system and retrieve the will, because it is an open document. It's a publicly available document. It shouldn't be withheld. Maybe there's a timing thing, you know, before someone passes away, it's a very confidential document. When they passed away, it's only when they passed away, it becomes public.
Okay, so that's very interesting. And also, just that is important to know, that the will is not public until you pass away. Because I actually had these are the kind of questions I get, Alex, and people send to me. So somebody wants to know, they are the life partner. They've formalized the arrangement to be a life partner, but she's worried that how his family are going to react to that now that it's in the will. And of course, no one will know until he passes away. So, I think these are important things, that anything you put in your will is not public knowledge until you pass away, and then you've gone. Then whatever the the land.
I don't know if I agree with that, though. I don't know if I agree with that, because we deal with thousands of estates with this particular, and look, sometimes it's just impossible to come through the front door. But I implore people to rather have the conversation before the inevitable has happened, because then everyone does understand. Everyone is aware. You're not dealing with that shock and horror and politics and all of that goes with it. So if it is absolutely possible, I implore you to have the tough conversations while you're still around.
I would agree with you 100%. The problem sometimes when there's children that the spouse is not aware of, and that's where we get into some very, very, maybe that's another whole topic altogether. But that is one of the ones I find a lot. And on nomination forms, remember, the trustees, now in the case of a pension fund, have to consider children from another relationship. And that is another whole can of worms. But yeah.
Just a fun story. Our consultants will tell you it'll happen to them once a week, because we've got consultants that go out and do the will. Yeah. They'll go see husband and wife, happens more often than not, they'll leave the appointment like 7, 8 o'clock at night, and they've done the will, and then they'll get this little call. Hi, I just need to add one more child. I didn't discuss it in the meeting with you. Happens all the time, Maya.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so that's the reality out there. Like I said, I'm sure you've seen so many of these situations. That's why it's so useful to chat to you. So going back to this idea of where you said it's very important that the life cover was left to the estate if you're wanting to leave it to a minor child. What other mistakes, and we've spoken about now, about the insight that you have, what other mistakes do you find people make when it comes to writing up a will that people should avoid or just be aware of?
So I mean, one particular mistake or example that comes to mind when you say how to best manage your will and your life cover beneficiaries is this particular estate. So what happened is this gentleman who's now passed, he's left us, he had a girlfriend and he had a child, and the girlfriend wasn't the mother of the child. And in his mind, I can see what he wanted to do. He left the life cover to his girlfriend under the sort of expectation to settle the bond on the house. And in his will, he left everything, including the house, to his little boy. The problem is then when he passed away, his girlfriend got the life cover because your viewers must understand life cover. If you've set a beneficiary, it'll pay the beneficiary. You can't stop it. Okay. I was the executive at Camelstop, so paid her, and she had no interest to settle the bond. Why would she? So she kept the money, and then we had to now give this property to this child. But how can you? It's got a bond on it. Debt, when you die, your debt doesn't go away. And so at the end of the day, we had to sell the property to settle the bond. And the child didn't get what the father didn't intend for. So that's the tragedy of it. And that's why I always say, when you're doing a will, you've got to look at your will, your life cover, and your pension benefits all happening in unison. And really a good financial advisor will be up to the task at hand.
I want to ask you that actually, did he stipulate in the will that he expected the life cover to be used for the bond? And if he had stipulated, would she have to oblige to it, be held to it?
No, because my life insurance sits under a different piece of legislation. The will has got one piece of legislation, pension fund is another piece of legislation, and life cover is another piece of legislation. They operate independently. Even if you put that in the will, there is nothing I can actually do as the executor to stop that beneficiary payout. That life company has to honor that. So if you're ever in doubt, just rather let it pay the estate, and then everything's flowing into the will and you've got one central place. You can manage everything.
Okay, so that's very interesting. So you could say, I've left the life cover to my girlfriend, but she must use it for the XYZ in the will. But that will has no... has no legal hold over that life cover. You see, that's the important thing. And I think that is also why it is worth getting advice when you're writing up your will, especially when there's kids involved. I mean, we've really spoken about, you know, moms worried about their children's futures. Now he's talking about this dad and the mistake he's made, leaving it. And that's certainly not how he wanted his son to leave his son, right? In that situation. Mm-hmm. So really, really important. But so let's talk about this part, Alex, because you guys obviously write up wills. That's part of what you do. But also what comes with wills is the cost of dying. So I had a look at, I thought my will was absolutely fine because I'm leaving everything to my husband. So there's no estate duty. There's no CGT. I have none of the taxes because when a spouse leaves to another spouse, there's no taxes. What I hadn't calculated was executive fees and transfer costs, property transfer costs. So the house, for example, is in my name. So it sits as my asset. Executive fees will apply to that asset. Plus, it will need to be transferred to my husband's name, which has another whole cost to it. And I'm looking at like hundreds of thousands of rands of fees that I did not expect. So let's unpack that a little bit. And how does one, create liquidity for these costs?
So that's exactly it. When you're doing a will, it can be a trap for your beneficiaries, because now all of a sudden, say for example, you've got an estate with a property, let's say it's 2 million rand, okay? You're looking at just over 100,000 rand just to execute that estate. That's a cash amount. That's 100,000+ rand you need to get from somewhere that wasn't around. I mean, if I asked you now to EFT 120,000 rand, you wouldn't necessarily have that on hand. And that's the problem with executive fees. One, they can add up very, very quickly, okay, at 3.5% of the estate before that, Maya. But two, you've got to find the money. And not many people have that much cash lying around when they pass away. And so then you hear these stories about executives having to sell houses and that those whole tragedies. It's because of these cash costs. And then to add insult to injury, when you registered your house, when you bought your house, you would have had a conveyance attorney register the title. It's a professional service. You need professionals. Professionals charge money. Perfectly acceptable. That needs to happen again because the title needs to go from you to your husband's name. So you get this double wham. You've got this 120,000 rand, and then you probably got another 40, 50,000 rand that needs to be found just to transfer the title of the property. So to solve it, what you could use life cover, you can use your cash in the bank. But I can guarantee you now, Maya, when I sit with beneficiaries and I say, please give me 160,000 rand so we can render these professional services that you didn't see coming, okay? Nothing is more antagonizing and more working against the whole grieving process than that particular situation. So what I always recommend is we do, not to give it too much of a pun, is we have a dedicated policy that just does that. It takes care of the fees. It doesn't do anything else. It literally provides a cashless estate from a fee point of view so that everything is fluid. It can just flow. We're not having that difficult conversation with your husband to say, I'm very sorry for your loss and here's a bill for 160K.
Mm-hmm. So this is an insurance policy that pretty much guarantees. So then if I pay the insurance policy, you're saying to me, on my death, there will be absolutely no fees relating to executive fees or property transfer costs. And what about testamentary trust, the child's trust that I spoke about earlier?
Yeah, so the policy does include that. So let's say, tragedy happens and your will probably says everything to your husband, failing your husband, then to your kids. When that happens, I suspect, and I hope you've got that children's trust. Trustees are professionals. Trustees charge fees every year, and it can add up to even more than the executor and the conveyance fee that we just discussed. So that particular policy also creates a dedicated supply of coverage for that. So you don't have to go chiseling away at the life cover that's paid out, chipping away at whatever's left in the bank accounts. Worst case, looking at selling assets. You've got this dedicated supply. Nothing can take from it. That's its job. Boom. Everything can run. We don't need to be second guessing how the professionals are going to get paid.
Okay, just also worth knowing, somewhere along the line, there's no such thing, by the way, as a free will. When you write up a will, somebody's going to be making money on the executive fees. That's where it comes along. So I suppose you can either take out, keep liquidity in your estate, you can take out a life cover yourself, which covers it, or you can buy a premium, such as you offer, that kind of says there will be no fees. Yeah, those are your various options. And just to end off, Alex, it seems quite obvious, but maybe for some people, just to clarify what makes a will valid. So if you want to go off and you're writing a will and you're signing it, what has to be in there for it to be valid?
So very quickly, first back to your point, your executors and your trustees. At the very simplest form, you just need to say who's going to get your estate. Okay, so you just need to say, my husband will get my estate, for example. And the last thing, you need to sign it correctly. So we touched on this earlier in the chat. You have to print it and sign it in its original form. You have to get two witnesses who are not your executors, who are not your beneficiaries, to say, that's my signature over there. That will make the will valid. And then just, I plead with your viewers, always have three original sign, one with you, one with your executor, and one with a trusted family member or your financial advisor, because stuff happens. And at least then we've got one of the three originals that we can execute on.
That's exactly what I've done as well, is because if you're just, you have one, that's the one thing many people forget. They've got the will, they stick it somewhere and no one can find it. So very important that you've got them in multiple places. So very, very important. And that you, as you said, wet ink, you've actually signed it. And it's not just digitally signed that's what you need to make
signed.
It to make
Maybe
it.
Digitally signed. Yeah. No, I can't.
Well, thank you so much, Alex. I'm sure our listeners and viewers have got a lot out of this. And I hope, really, one thing I wish, and I was speaking to some people this weekend who I discovered didn't have wills, and I said to them, please, by the end of September, make sure you have a signed and valid will, because there is nothing worse that you can do to your family than dying without a will and dying interstate, as we said. It can take years to wind up that estate, and the costs just keep mounting, because we've spoken about executive fees, but I mean, now if you have to add on having to go to the courts to appoint an executor, to argue wills, when families start arguing and legal, bringing in lawyers, it can get really, really expensive. So do yourself a favor, decide what you want, don't overthink it, go and sign a will or go and get a professional to help you draw one up. So thank you, Alex.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.